from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. While the United States and North Korea have been engaged in cyber warfare for the past decade, cybersecurity has largely been absent from President Trump and Kim Jong-un's nuclear disarmament discussions.
Cyber is not included in any of these discussions with North Korea. They want to do nuclear biochem, and yet cyber is the only weapon that they've actually used against us and used effectively.
That was David Sanger, national security correspondent for the New York Times and author of a new book, The Perfect Weapon. Coming up on Forum, Sanger will join us to discuss the changing nature of global combat and how the U.S. government is grossly unprepared to deal with cyber threats. That's next, after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Just a decade ago, the threat of cyber attacks was largely absent from the annual threat assessment that U.S. intelligence agencies prepared for Congress. That's according to New York Times national security correspondent David Sanger. But now, after Russian hackers broke into the Democratic National Committee's computer systems in 2015, and as evidence mounts that foreign entities have placed malware in U.S. electrical grids, cyber attacks rank as the nation's number one threat. David Sanger, who shared three Pulitzer Prizes for his reporting at the Times, has been investigating the newest technologies of war, and he joins us now to talk about his new book, The Perfect Weapon, all about the scope and severity of the cyber threat against the U.S. and how prepared the nation is for the growing onslaught of cyber attacks on its systems and institutions. He was also in Singapore for the recent North Korea summit. We'll get his take on that as well, and welcome back to Forum, David Sanger.
Great to be back with you, Michael.
Well, let's begin with North Korea, because you were there and you asked a number of questions at the press conference, dealt with the Trump team. The assessment seems to be that not much came out of that, at least where the United States is concerned, in terms of whatever.
Yeah, right. It was certainly nonspecific. Look, I give enormous credit to President Trump for the instinct to go out and have a direct meeting with Kim Jong-un. For 35 years that I've been covering the North Korea stuff, since I was a young reporter in Tokyo and wrote some of the first pieces about the existence of the program in North Korea at a time Americans basically had not heard about it. We have been trying one method, which is go try to strike a deal with the North Koreans and dangle the possibility that there could be some rapprochement and a meeting of presidents. And it never worked. You sign the deal. A few years later, it would dissipate. And the next thing you knew, the North Koreans were setting off nuclear weapons. They were testing intercontinental ballistic missiles. And we were back in the same process. And I think the president had the right instinct. He had to break the cycle and try to develop a relationship directly with Kim Jong-un and try to see if in a society where all authority sort of flows down from the top, that an overall agreement from him would then force the North Korean bureaucracy and military to do what they needed to do. That said, I don't know that it's going to work. And the agreement that he got, because he was so desperate to keep the meeting going, was more vaguely worded than what we had seen from the North Korean government in 1994, when Kim's grandfather was still alive, in 2005, and in 2008. And what worries me now is that the president, having come back and declared we no longer face a threat from North Korea, that Kim Jong-un will say, well, this is great. All I had to do was go to Singapore, nice town. They took me on a tour of sort of the nightlife spots. We met, we had a nice lunch, and he declared that the threat was over. Back to work, guys.
Yeah, total denuclearization. We kept hearing that over and over again. Of course, there wasn't any talk at all about cyber weapons, and we want to get into that with you. But also, you know, I picked up a copy of the new Bloomberg edition, Bloomberg Business. Maybe you saw it, and the headline was Investing in North Korea. I mean, Trump was talking about these beaches and everything. And so, according to some wags, he really threw out a lot of temptation in front of young Kim Jong-un and said, you know, you can do like these countries that are near you. You can build, you know, enormous empires, like maybe even have a Trump Tower.
Well, you know, he approached this the way he would approach a real estate deal. And the president's, having done the Times' foreign policy interviews with my colleague Maggie Haberman with Mr. Trump prior to the election, and I spent about three and a half hours with him on various foreign policy issues, and then dealt with him a bit since he's been president. He approaches everything as if every nation, every leader is motivated by what motivates him, which is the profit that would come out of a development deal, a real estate deal, and so forth. If you're Kim Jong-un, there's only one thing that truly motivates you, which is assuring regime survival. If he can get investment money along the way, that's great. But I'm not persuaded that he's going to give up his nuclear weapons in order to do that. I am persuaded that he may be willing to give up some of them and enter what he would view as arms control talks, because that would make him sort of play the role of the Soviet Union or now Russia, and talk about numbers, but get an agreement from the United States that they that North Korea is a de facto nuclear power.
But we had just talked about this after the G7 and after the insulting of Justin Trudeau, and then he goes off to Singapore and says he loves about Kim Jong-un, he loves his people. And these are people that have been kept in starvation, have been sent to gulags, killing members of his own family and everything. I mean, you wonder, what is he thinking about,
you know,
Trump?
There is something in President Trump that, as many have observed, treasures strong leaders and thus even dictators over almost anything else, because President Trump doesn't like the process of governing and bringing along democratic governance. So if he's dealing with a dictator, he can strike his deal one-on-one the way he could when he was back in the real estate business. Now, as for developing the beaches in North Korea, I just offer one caution. I was in North Korea for a 10 or 12-day trip quarter century ago. They took us on a train from Pyongyang, the capital, all the way up to that tiny sliver where China, Russia, and North Korea all meet. And along the way, we stopped off at one of those beautiful beaches, and they actually had a full picnic for us. And it was nice. The beaches are nice. But I do have to warn the president before they do the development deal that we were told not to wander outside of a sort of cordoned off area where we were having the lunch, because the rest of the beach had been mined in case of an American or South Korean invasion. So they may want to bring in a few demining devices before they start building the hotels.
Well, Defense Secretary Mattis, just said this week he's not aware of any indications that North Korea has taken concrete steps to dismantle any more of its infrastructure for the launching of ballistic missiles or any additional steps to fully denuclearize since the summit.
That's right. Now, we're only 8 days out. It was a week ago Tuesday that the president met Kim Jong-un. We had expected that there would be a fairly rapid follow-up meeting between Americans and the North Koreans. That hasn't happened. Instead, Kim went to China. And what worries me about this is that the Chinese interest here is just making sure the status quo holds. And so
they don't want all those refugees.
They don't want all those refugees, but also they don't want all those Americans,
investing in throughout North Korea.
Or taking over North Korea if North Korea collapses, right? So they just wanted to get rid of the threat that President Trump would bomb North Korea, get into a conflict with them. And, you know, at this point, the interesting question is, if the North Koreans don't deliver, does President Trump call them out on it now, or is he so invested in the success of what he did in Singapore that basically he will not be critical of them?
Well, I don't know my private theory. I think he wants a Nobel Prize.
He's been pretty clear about that.
Yeah. We're talking to David Sanger, and David Sanger is national security correspondent for the New York Times, author of The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. And I want to talk about The Perfect Weapon. Before I do, we talked last hour about child separation. How do you read? You've been a Trump observer now for quite a while, actually worked as a correspondent, White House correspondent, dealt a lot with him personally. Again, there's a kind of crazy flip-flop there in many ways. I mean, he was playing it tough. I'm going to separate these felons from their children. And then he did one pivot. And then today, the Washington Post has reported that he's done another pivot. And he said, essentially, we're going to do away with we're going to move toward immigration reform again.
So this is completely typical Donald Trump, which is take a position, escalate, make it appear that you will never back down, not unlike the fire and fury line about North Korea from just last summer, right? And then when it looks like either you have succeeded, which he believes in the North Korean case he did, into scaring them into a summit, or you believe that the forces arrayed against you are overwhelming, do a 180-degree pivot and just deny that you're pivoting. And basically that's where he is right now. I've actually, in the time that he has been president, not seen him back down as fully as he did yesterday on the issue of separating the pairs. Now, think about
Ivanka and Melania, you think?
So Ivanka, Melania, all of the first ladies, including the one he is married to. When Laura Bush and Ted Cruz are on the same side of an issue and allied against you, you got to think you really have lost the spectrum of your own party.
And they're both Texans as well. We're talking again with David Sanger, and we're going to talk about cyber warfare because, as I said, this is now in many people's minds, and according to a report that I cited in the introduction, number one threat. Now, many people would say, how could that be a bigger threat than the nuclear threat or than the threat, for that matter, of biological warfare, chemical warfare? But it is.
Well, it is, but it's a different kind of threat. So first, to the history of this, in 2007, when the intelligence community delivered its annual threat assessment report and unclassified report to Congress. When I went back through these, what struck me in 07, and remember, we were only 4 years into the Iraq War, and in 07, the war was going really badly, and people were quite concerned about another 9/11 and so forth. You can go through the entire threat assessment report and not see the word cyber once. For the past 4 years, it's been the number one threat, as you say, ahead of nuclear proliferation, ahead of chemical and biological. That does not mean that a nuclear strike, a chemical or a biological strike couldn't be more devastating and more deadly. But the chances of it are relatively low because the chances, particularly for nuclear, that we will know where it comes from and we know how to retaliate is extraordinarily high. In cyber, it's almost the opposite of nuclear weapons. The threat is pervasive. You can dial it up or dial it down. You can hide pretty easily where it comes from. The chances that you'll get retaliated against are pretty low. When you think of all of the cyber attacks on the United States since in the past 4 or 5 years, the Iranian attacks in response to what the United States did to take out Iran's nuclear program with cyber weapons.
With Israel.
With Israel, that's right. And we can get back to that one in a moment because it's where my last book sort of left off and where this one picks up. If you look at our attacks on the North Korean or the North Korean attacks on Sony and on the Federal Reserve and then our counterattacks on their missile program, if you look at what the Russians did during the election or what the Chinese have done to steal intellectual property, one thing in common is that they have paid almost no price at all. And people have come, states have come to recognize that cyber is the best way to go attack an adversary and probably face no retaliation. And that's why it has become the primary means that states use now to undercut each other.
That's why you call it the perfect weapon, in addition to the fact that not only are there no tracks, as you alluded to before, but it's cheap, a lot cheaper than those other weapons.
Dirt cheap. So look, if the North Koreans can afford to mount sophisticated attacks against Sony here in California or against the Federal Reserve, the SWIFT system, to go steal money out of central banks, they got $83 million out of the Bangladeshi central bank. They would have gotten $1 billion had they not made a spelling error in the bank transfer instruction. It's just like your mother said, reread your work for spelling mistakes before you turn it in. If they had not done that, they would have gotten $1 billion. But in each of those cases, they have learned the spectrum. And most Americans don't think of cyber as a spectrum. In the physical world, we understand there are like handguns and there are automatic weapons, and then there are tanks and military equipment, and then there are missiles, and then there are nuclear missiles. In cyber, it's everything from code that can steal material, money out of your bank account, code that can change data, alter data. I alter your medical data, which could be a problem if you went for transfusion, or code that could speed up or slow down your centrifuges in your nuclear plant and make them blow up, which is what the U.S. and Israel did in Olympic Games, which was the code name for
Forgive me, not to mention power grids and cell phones and emergency response systems and communication systems, and on we go.
That's right. And, you know, we've gotten better, Michael, at protecting our critical infrastructure. I would say the utilities and the financial industry have probably done the most because they've invested the most in resiliency. Basically, if something goes out, have a backup system that can run in. And that's a good form of deterrence. But the fact of the matter is that while we have gotten better, the attack surfaces have gotten so much bigger because we've connected so much to the internet. That Alexa that you keep in your living room, your internet-connected refrigerator. I've still never figured out why we needed an internet-connected refrigerator. Your car, your coming autonomous vehicle, all of these create new attack surfaces. So while our cybersecurity is improving, the scope of the problem is expanding faster than we could ever keep up with.
And that means more countries. What are we up to now, about 30 by reckoning?
Probably 30 or 40 that have significant cyber talent. The big four among our adversaries are Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea, but many other countries have the capability. And, of course, we invest billions of dollars a year in cyber weaponry that we never talk about. The British do as well. The Israelis do it as well. And Germany has just created its own cyber corps. And many other countries are creating their own.
What do we know about these implants? We know they're there, right? And in terms of being able to actually determine how many implants are in our utility grids or in, for that matter, our nuclear. Well, you know, we got Diablo Canyon here in California, places
sure.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it could all be implanted, right?
There are implants throughout our electrical grid, many planted by the Russians, some planted by others. And the question is, how much do you need to worry about it? So let's back up for people who may not have initially heard the phrase an implant. In the cyber world, that just means that I have secretly put a bit of code that I can use to manipulate your system inside the system, and it's sitting and growing there. A way to think about it is that is sort of a port that a doctor puts in if you've got to get treated for something and they want to
like
be
lung cancer.
Like
lung, yeah.
For cancer, yeah. That's right. And an implant does two things. You can put a probe in it and sort of figure out what's going on inside the body. Or you can use it to actually inject drugs and affect what's happening inside the body. So we see implants in our electrical grid and we immediately rush to the conclusion that the Russians are getting ready to go take it down. Which maybe they are, but maybe for a while they're just monitoring it and trying to figure out how the system works. Because a cyber attack—
They're too busy monitoring our elections anyway.
That's right. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But with an implant, the intent is not immediately clear. So the problem with this is that we yell and we scream about the Russians putting implants in our systems. And then I say to my friends and interview subjects in the U.S. government, well, and this is somewhat of a malicious question, why don't we just try to set an international norm that no one will place implants in critical infrastructure that could affect civilians? Nothing in the power grid, certainly nothing in your election system. You know, why don't we just sort of set that up as sort of part of the Geneva Conventions of the new cyber world. The first thing they say, David, I didn't go quite that far. The reason, of course, is the United States has put tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of implants in foreign systems. And the book takes you into a program called Nitro Zeus, which was a program to basically unplug all of Iran in case we got into a conflict with them before the 2015 nuclear agreement, the one that President Trump has since pulled out of. And that would have done exactly what we worry about the Russians doing to us.
Again, we're talking to David Sanger, and he'll be speaking at the World Affairs Council tonight at 6:30. His new book is out, and it's called The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. So, David, are we utterly, completely unprepared?
We are not utterly and completely unprepared. As I said before, the utilities and financial industry have done a pretty good job. Our problem is we keep getting surprised, and we keep getting surprised because we're not thinking ahead to what is truly vital data. So I'll give you two examples. The Department of Homeland Security's list of critical infrastructure in 2016 had banks, power stations, all the things you would expect. It even had national monuments, right? So the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, they're all on the list. What was missing? Our election system. The fundamental infrastructure that supports our democracy was not listed as critical infrastructure. And when Jay Johnson, who was the Secretary of Homeland Security, suddenly in response to what the Russians were doing, suggested that we do that, he had an uproar from secretaries of state, particularly in Georgia, some other states as well, who said, we're not going to allow the federal government to take over our election system. He wasn't trying to take it over. He was trying to put it on that list of things that we paid attention to protecting. Another great example, when the Chinese came in to the Office of Personnel Management, the most boring bureaucracy in Washington, and that's saying a lot, which keeps the records for everybody who goes and applies for security clearances. The Chinese came in and cleared out 22 million security files out of this that gave them a picture of the American elite who have security clearances, where they'd worked, who they're related to, who they are married to, how many kids they have, what their medical history. We're not just talking, you know, name and social security number and birth date here. Far more data. None of that was highly protected. It wasn't even encrypted. They were keeping it in the Interior Department's spare computer space. No wonder the Chinese walked out with it.
We invite you to join us. I know many of you have questions or concerns or comments. We're talking about David Sanger on global conflict in the cyber age, and President Trump has indicated that he wants to continue this. We'll talk a little bit about deterrence and what can be done other than something like a Geneva Convention, which David alluded to earlier. But I'd like to hear from you, your thoughts, your concerns, and any questions or comments you might have. Our toll-free number is available right now, and you can join us at 866-733-6786. Please feel free to be part of the program. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or join us on our Facebook page. We do want to hear from you, and we want you to join us, so please feel free to do that now. Again, the book is called The Perfect Weapon: War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age, and you can meet David Sanger this evening. He'll be at the World Affairs Council in San Francisco at 6:30. When we return, we'll talk about deterrence, and we'll hear from you. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with David Sanger. He's national security correspondent for The New York Times, author of The Perfect Weapon: War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. And he'll be speaking at the World Affairs Council tonight at 6:30. And we're going to go to your calls and emails. I did promise that I would at least cover and get David Sanger's response to deterrence. But I want to add to that one other thing, and that's transparency, because often when we talk about nuclear weaponry, the United States has to be more transparent, so the argument goes, and other countries have to diminish their stockpiles and so forth. But the United States can take a leading role here. It's probably not going to take that role under the Trump administration. How transparent should we be, can we be, and what do we do about deterrence?
Well, Michael, it's good that you mentioned nuclear, because that's the image people immediately turn to. They think, well, we worked out deterrence in nuclear weapons. Why don't we do the same in cyber?
And forgive me, also think of MAD, Mutual Assured
Mutually
Destruction.
Mutually Assured Destruction. So why does it work in nuclear, or at least it's worked so far, and it doesn't work as well in cyber? And the answer to that is, first, we have a limited number of players. There are only 9 countries that we know of that actually have nuclear weapons. Secondly, you can go into a big cave in Colorado as a nuclear weapon is launched, and unless it's coming in by, you know, a terrorist putting it on a freighter or something like that, you can see where it's coming from. decide whether you're going to try to intercept it or not, and you can then obviously retaliate. And so the country that launches it knows that, you know, 45 minutes later, they too will be incinerated. None of that is true in cyber. You can't see where it's being launched from. Eventually, we may well determine, as we did when the WannaCry attacks last year came from North Korea and that NotPetya came from Russia. But it took months for a public attribution to happen. And because you can dial them up and down, it's very hard for a president to say, we're going to go destroy your country for doing a cyber attack on our movie studio or hitting some of our banks. It's just not proportionate. So the old methods of deterrence do not work. Let's add to that.
Is there, however, some deterrence when it comes to what's often cited as a cyber war, Pearl Harbor? I mean, you know,
yes,
where things are kind of all out and an attack happens, because that would indeed foster retaliation immediately. And so
if you took out all of the lights from San Francisco to L.A., it's a good chance you're going to end up seeing a military response. And countries seem to know that. And in fact, embedded in the new nuclear posture review that Secretary Mattis published back in January, and this is actually the opening of the book, he said, in the case of a massive non-nuclear attack on the infrastructure of the United States, we reserve to use the right to use nuclear weapons in response. And that also may not be credible. I'm not sure we would ever make first use of a nuclear weapon in response to a non-nuclear attack, no matter how big. But that was an effort to create some deterrence here. The other way to do deterrence is deterrence by denial, to convince a country that our resilience is so good that they shouldn't even bother because it's not going to work. But our resilience isn't that good. So that's part of the difficulty. But you asked about transparency. And I would argue, as somebody who spent a lot of his life covering both nuclear and cyber, we're a lot more transparent in the nuclear arena. We publish exactly how many nuclear weapons we have. People know pretty much where they are. We publish how many are deployed and how many are in storage. We've reached nuclear agreements with Russia that limit these numbers, right? We have mutual inspectors who come back and forth. We look to make sure that the Russians are keeping within the numbers and vice versa. We had a nuclear inspection regime. It's fortunately still running with Iran even after the president's decision. In cyber, because the weapon itself was created by the intelligence community, which is pretty rare, everything about it has been kept secret. So secret, I would argue, what kind of weapons we have, what our capabilities are, when we might use them and when we might not, that we're actually stepping on our own deterrence. You know, when I revealed the decision-making by Presidents Obama and Bush to attack Iran using a cyber weapon.
Stuxnet,
right, yeah. which was called within the government Operation Olympic Games, and that was big subject of my last book, Confront and Conceal, 6 years ago. The government then had a brief debate. Well, do we embrace these revelations and just say, yeah, we did that, and we could do a lot more to you if you keep building your centrifuges, right? Or do we start a leak investigation and figure out who's talking about this? And of course, they went with option number two. They've never acknowledged that the U.S. and Israel were central to it, although the book will take you into discussions I had with the head of the Mossad, who's since passed away, on this subject. And the core problem here is that we have made so much secret that we can't get into a public conversation about what we're willing to give up. That conversation that says, well, maybe we're willing to give up messing in other people's elections if we can get a norm that no one will mess in ours.
Let's bring our callers aboard here. And we begin, Rob, with you. Join us. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Very interesting topic. Two questions. One is, you mentioned how it was nice to hear that the financial systems and some of the power plants do have some countermeasures. But is the United States government spending enough on countermeasures to this worldwide? And the second question is, the thing that's always freaked me out is the idea of these self-driving cars that are, I feel like they're trying to shove down our throats. Is that ever going to be a platform that can be secured well enough to not be turned into some kind of a weaponized problem all over the place, because we know the cars can be hacked?
Well, two excellent questions, Rob. On the first one, I would say that one of the biggest challenges we have is that most of the cyber targets in the United States do not belong to the government of the United States. They belong to private industry. And it's up to private industry to go invest in protecting it. So for the banks and the utilities, they have such an overwhelming interest in spending billions of dollars in protection that it's understandable. But for smaller businesses or smaller utilities or savings and loans in small towns, they're not going to have that kind of resource. Most of those companies do not want the U.S. government crawling around inside their systems because they're persuaded that the U.S. government will find other things or interfere in other ways and that it's got sort of a big brother nature to it. One of the proposals that has been kicking around U.S. Cyber Command, recently elevated to a full military command, is to go attack this problem the way counterterrorism works. You know, and we don't wait for people to bring bombs into the country on airplanes. We go and kick down the doors in Pakistan or some other place and try to find the bomb makers. And if you go back and you look at U.S. Cyber Command's new mission statements, they talk about taking this combat overseas and wiping out the malware before it hits the United States. Well, it makes strategic sense, but it's very risky because you blow up a series of servers in, I'm making this up, China. And the Chinese say, those servers didn't have malware on it. Those coders were sitting there developing educational software for, you know, kindergarten through third graders. And you came along and blew it up and did the first attack. Now, they may be lying about what the purpose was, but you'll never manage to prove it.
Well, there is an analogy to the nuclear. You know, we're going to have nuclear energy in Iran rather than use this. I've got a caller on here I think you may know, and that's Jonathan Ryder, who is a former head of cyber strategy for the Pentagon under President Obama. And Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Jonathan.
Thanks, Michael. David, great to hear your voice. So, David, first of all, congratulations on the book. Really looking forward to reading it. And this is a rich conversation about deterrence, and we could go in all sorts of different directions. The one thing I want to ask you, David, in your reporting and research is the degree to which you think the actions the Trump administration have taken against Russia or other counter-response options that the governments have taken, for example, against the Iranian hackers for the indictments or the Chinese indictments of a number of years ago, the degree to which you think these kinds of response actions have may or may not have any deterrent effect so far?
It's a very good question. So we'll go with the second one first, which is treating this as criminal activity and indicting members of the PLA, which the U.S. did for Unit 61398. That was a People's Liberation Army unit that was stealing a lot of industrial material. And then they went and indicted, as you pointed out, some Iranian hackers who appeared to have pretty close ties to the Iranian government. In all of those cases, we were under no illusions that there would ever be a trial. None of those hackers were inside the United States. They'll probably never see the inside of a courtroom. I think it did spook the Chinese into reaching an agreement with President Obama, and that was somewhat helpful. On the responses to the Russia hack, the book is quite critical, Jonathan, of the Obama administration, not just for underreacting to the hack, but for underreacting to the Russian hacks that preceded the DNC. Remember, before the Russians went into the DNC, and sometimes at the same time, they were into the State Department, the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon, and the White House unclassified email system. They fought the NSA for 2 weeks when the NSA tried to get them out of the White House system. They did that mostly just to show that they could stay around and be there. The Obama administration made a decision not to name the Russians as the ones who had hacked in. Basically, they covered up the details. Well,
They didn't want to seem like they were influencing the election, pretty
this
much.
This was before the election, Michael.
Yeah, no,
this
I understand.
Nothing to, this was before the DNC hack. This was 2014 and 2015. They didn't name them for that. So if Putin looks at this and he says, well, they're not going to call me out for going into the White House system, who's going to care about the DNC, which is basically run by a bunch of college kids, right? So I think that we failed at our deterrence before the DNC. Then the DNC happens, and the president, you know, becomes public in the summer of or June of 2016, just about 2 years ago this week, I think it became public. And what happens then? President Obama is rightly concerned that if he calls them out, they could escalate, the Russians could escalate and go after the voting machines on election day, and that would play into the Donald Trump argument that the election's rigged. And since they all assumed Hillary would win and that this would be used to delegitimize her presidency, you can see what was going through their heads. Now, they had that wrong, too. But in doing the interviews for the book, I went to just about everybody who was a witness to those discussions or participant in those discussions who I could find and convince to talk to me. And while a few defended the president's approach, including senior people like Susan Rice, the national security advisor, and Lisa Monaco, who was the Homeland Security advisor, I had many others who say to me, you know, if we had this one back, we would have gone after Putin a lot harder.
Maybe I can ask you, Jonathan, to respond.
Right. I think that's it's hard to make a decision. There's a great book, Thinking in Time, that Ernie May wrote many years ago. It's like you're caught in a particular moment in time and you've got a number of different driving forces upon you. And I can't imagine what it was like for the president to look at the political space in the United States and say, look, if I do something, it could tip the election one way or another.
James Comey decided to take that decision. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean that's interesting, and we could speak at length about that. But the point that I think I'd like to raise is actually that I think the Trump administration's indictments and sanctions of Russia, not only for the election hacks, but for the increased intrusions onto the energy grid and the critical infrastructure penetrations that they've done that the Trump administration did in the last two months, I think is really a good step in the right direction. It describes to the American people that this risk is real. We're confirming that it's happened. It's not just that they were in Ukraine. They were inside our grid, and we're now going to sanction them. So it describes a response option. But then it also says to the country, you need to start investing. And in order for you to invest, there's obviously a range of platforms and security tools you can buy to prevent breaches from occurring. So that I think is a really positive step. And David, I'm curious for your reactions to that as well.
I would agree, Jonathan. I think that was a positive step. I also would give them credit for naming the North Koreans and the Russians in those attacks. I'm a little worried about what's going to happen going forward, because when John Bolton came in as national security advisor, he then eliminated the position of cybersecurity coordinator underneath him in the National Security Council. It had belonged to, that job had been held by Rob Joyce, who used to run, worked in the NSA, lifetime NSA employee.
What was the rationale for that? Do you know?
He ran something called the Tailored Access Operations Unit, which breaks into foreign systems. So we actually had an offensive cyber warrior in that job for the first time. That job had been around for a long time, and certainly when Jonathan was serving in the government, that job was around as well. They gave no rationale other than cyber is everywhere and we're integrating it into everything. Well, you know, yes, but the government responses to this have been wildly uncoordinated. So the idea of getting rid of your coordinator struck me as not something that made a lot of sense.
Jonathan, let me thank you for the call and go to a comment that, is related to what we're talking about here. Bonnie wants to know, how comfortable are you with the Trump administration's work to improve cybersecurity, especially regarding elections?
Not very. I think that when President Trump came in, he had a brief moment to say, you know what, I won this election legitimately. There's no evidence that the Russians moved any individual vote. And to this day, I mean, it's very hard to figure out whether the propaganda, the Facebook stuff, and so forth.
Excuse me, if you listen to James Clapper, who was on the show,
yes,
he's convinced otherwise.
He's convinced it has, but he can't provide any evidence. None of us can, because you'd have to get inside the heads of
Putin,
of Americans, about to figure out whether or not these actually changed their mind. And I just can't do that. And we'll never know for sure. I heard what Mr. Clapper said. Yeah, that goes beyond what his own intelligence reports, you know, that he issued at the time said. But I think he's got an interesting view on it. But the key point to remember here is there were huge numbers of lessons to be learned from the Russia hack. And the president could have said, we need a 9/11-like commission to go figure out what happened here and make sure it never happens again, not just from the Russians, but from anybody else. He was unable to do that because every time he heard Russia hack, he thought the legitimacy of his own presidency was being called into question, and by some it was. And so instead, he created this ridiculous commission to find the 3 million fraudulent votes that didn't exist, and that's since disbanded without reporting.
I'm wondering, there's always been a concern about legislators not being really aware enough or informed enough when it comes to technology, not really understanding a lot of the technology. This would be true, I presume, for cyber warfare, too, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. You've got a lot of members of Congress, a lot of older members of Congress who don't use computers, don't live on the net the way many, many Americans do, don't understand the technology. Some who are actually technophobes and sort of joke about it as if that makes them like endearing to the rest of us. It scares the hell out of me because it would be, to my mind, as unforgivable as saying, well, nuclear weapons are complex. I'm not going to learn about this and thus abrogate Congress's responsibility for overseeing our nuclear strategy, key to our national survival. So I don't think there's an excuse anymore. There is a younger, more tech-savvy group of people who have come into Congress. You know, I've spent a lot of time in dealing with this book, talking to people like Will Hurd of Texas, who's a former CIA officer, very savvy on these kinds of issues. Adam Schiff, you hear a lot about from the Intelligence Committee. He spent a lot of time. Some older members of Congress, I think, have come up the curve a long way, including Richard Burr, the Republican who's heading the Senate Intelligence Committee. I did a long interview with him a few months ago and was impressed with how he had gotten his head around the essence of it. You don't need to be a coder to understand what's going on here, but you need to delve enough into the technology that you can handle it. And that's really why I wrote The Perfect Weapon, Michael, because the technologists were operating without much knowledge of the geopolitics of what was what their inventions were creating, what kind of change it was making in the way countries compete and undercut each other. And the geostrategists were all sitting around here talking about a technology that they don't really spend much time studying. And my effort here was to try to write a book that could appeal to both.
If the race is on, and there is a race, just like there was with nuclear weaponry on cyber warfare, where's the United States? Are we ahead of Russia and China? And to what degree are we ahead of Russia and China, in your judgment?
We're ahead of them, but not by much. As you said, the cost of entry here is so low. The talent pool is so great. The talent pool is international. The talent pool does not need to be within your borders. I mean, think about the DNC hack. The last time the DNC lost data, a group of Watergate burglars had to go jimmy open the door and bust open the file cabinets, and they got a small amount of data. If you go into the basement of the DNC today, the old file cabinet is still there. The bottom handle is busted. It's still broken open, right? And next to it, they have a tiny little server which had all of the data that the Russians got. You'd lose it in one of the file drawers. And that server got broken into by people who never even had to enter the country.
I was thinking, reading about the DNC hack and so forth, there's no reason to anticipate that we won't face similar problems in the November elections. I mean, it's already being anticipated by many, isn't it?
Yeah, and it may not be from the Russians. I mean,
yeah, it could be from anybody.
The great thing in cyber is everybody learns from everybody else. So when the Stuxnet code got free because somebody made a mistake and started spreading around the world, the first thing that happened is the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, the North Koreans all chopped it up and learned from it and used it in their own weapons. When the National Security Agency, pardon me, when the National Security Agency lost many of its cyber weapons to a group called shadow brokers, we still don't fully understand who they are, but we believe Russia is behind distributing these. They lost their own weapons. The North Koreans used them to shoot at the British and others in the WannaCry attack. Now, in the physical world, if we had lost parts of a missile and an adversary nation had taken those parts and the technology from it and shot it at an ally, someone would be court-martialed. In cyber, because we didn't even want to admit that these were NSA-developed weapons, no one got court-martialed. No one even got chastised.
Here's a tweet from Olivia. Says, most people don't understand how cyberspace works and therefore have no clue how susceptible we are to hacking. That sort of coincides with what I said before about legislators. But let me read another comment here from Stephen, who says, we hear it can be impossible to tell where a cyber attack comes from, yet so many have happened in the past attributed to particular countries or groups. So my question is, when can we tell where an attack comes from and when can we not?
Well, it's a very good question. So there are a couple of different ways to figure out where an attack comes from. One is forensic. So if you took apart a piece of code, you'll see things in it that will give you pretty good clues. Like the code itself will usually have timestamps on it about where things were written and when. And if it's in the working hours of, you know, office hours in Moscow, you know, that first clue is not conclusive. Coders from different countries have different styles, so it leaves a bit of a DNA to it. Then, of course, there's timing and motive. So, you know, if the code is going after something that is of great interest to the Russians or the Chinese or whatever, or to the North Koreans, and they've publicly announced that something was a target, it's a pretty good guess. So in the case of the Sony attack, the North Koreans had complained about a movie called The Interview that posited that two journalists who were going off to interview Kim Jong-un were hired by the CIA to assassinate him.
Which you said correctly was not a very good movie, to put it mildly.
It was a truly terrible movie, okay? And
you're doing some movie critiques on the side here, but you're absolutely right.
I'm not paid as a movie reviewer, but I would go with Jonathan's recommendation of reading Ernie May's old book, Thinking in Time, in those 2 hours that you might otherwise waste watching The Interview. But that said, the North Koreans were quite clear that they were going to stop that movie from distributing. And then when we got to the code itself, then the intelligence agencies were able to go back through implants they had in the North Korean systems and figure out where it came from.
You come to a conclusion to some degree that we're going to need some kind of political solution to stop all this escalation.
That's right. So this is a comparison with nuclear. So in nuclear, we tried technological solutions. We've built missile defense. Okay. Everyone raise their hand if you feel completely convinced that our missile defenses would stop an attack on the United States. Of course we think it wouldn't. It adds to deterrence, but it doesn't do much. But then we've also worked toward political solutions. Reduce the number of weapons that we each have pointed at each other. Come to some agreements about when you would never use nuclear weapons. Announce your own policies so that it's somewhat reassuring to the rest of the world. And we're going to need to do the same in cyber. There are some technical solutions that will get rid of 85% of the problem, but that problem that you're getting rid of are the criminals and the sort of harassment stuff. You can do a lot to filter. If you use a Gmail account or any other commercial email account, Google is filtering stuff, getting rid of a lot of junk so that you're not getting spammed. That's a technological solution. For the state-on-state cyber, we're going to need to begin to move to some actual state-on-state political solutions. I would argue treaties don't fit in this. They take too long. The technology will overtake the treaty.
Your guest sounds, Carl tweets, a little confused. We're prepared, but we keep getting surprised. What does that mean?
It means that we are preparing for the kinds of cyber attacks we have seen and that we can anticipate. And we have a failure of imagination about the ones that we don't anticipate.
Just like 9/11.
Just like 9/11. So let me. There's a chapter in the book called Putin's Petri Dish, and it's about Ukraine. So in Ukraine, you saw everything that was used against the United States in 2016. You saw manipulating elections, propaganda that moved out over the internet, false Facebook postings, and you saw power grids that were brought down. We sent a group of inspectors, of experts to Ukraine to examine what happened to the power grids when the Russians took it down. What we didn't do was send a group of experts to go look at what they were doing with the election system. And so the electric power grid people come back and they issue their report and it circulated around everybody. And meanwhile, the Russians were off in our election system. The evidence was right there in Ukraine. We just couldn't imagine it being used here.
We'll have to leave it there. Always good to have you, David. Thank you.
Great to be with you, Michael.
Congratulations on your book. It's called The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. And again, you can meet the author. He'll be at the World Affairs Council in San Francisco tonight at 6:30 p.m. He's national security correspondent for The New York Times. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Always remind you, you can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. We're produced by Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, and Christina Kim. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Engineer today is Howard Gelman. And engagement producer Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Font. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.